is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Bill Raggio, Tom Jossen. The Foundation for the Defense of Democracy's Long War Journal, they and their colleagues keep the scale of the conflict in the Ummah from the Hindu Kush to the Mediterranean. These last months and weeks and days, we've focused on Afghanistan following the president's decision in April to withdraw last combat forces of the U.S. and its NATO ISAF allies. The result now is fog of war. So we plunge into the story knowing the headlines from London will continue to change. London, Europe, Asia is watching this catastrophe. It reads at the London Telegraph. Afghanistan latest news. 5 killed at Kabul airport as desperate Afghans scramble to escape. Subhead. Afghan asylum seekers will be allowed to flee Taliban to Britain without a passport. Subhead. Kabul airport in chaos as thousands overrun runway in desperate bid to escape Taliban. Subhead. Ben Wallace, the UK Secretary of Defense, breaks down as he admits some will be left behind in Afghanistan. The Financial Times, the equivalent of the Wall Street Journal for Europe, for the London audience. At least 5 dead as Afghans swarm airport after Taliban takes controls. Crowds surround U.S. military aircraft running. Evacuations after all civilian flights ceased. Gentlemen, here we have right now fog of war, and it is important to lay out the map of Afghanistan since April and the months before April to see how the Taliban advanced all the way to the palace in Kabul. Bill, I start with you because you've been keeping this map since 2014. The districts, the provinces, the edge of the border of Afghanistan on Pakistan, on Iran. What is it that you saw as early as 2020, but certainly since the president's announcement that told you the Taliban was launching a march on Kabul? Good day to you.
Good day to you, John. Not a good day for the Afghan people. Their country is under the thumb of the Taliban again. This is an absolute disaster. But to your question, so this is, we actually have to walk this back to 2014 when the U.S. military transferred control of primary security to the Afghan forces. I recognized very early on that the Taliban had a rural insurgency strategy. And what it was doing was it was going to take control of rural areas and expand out. The U.S. and Afghan forces had a population centric strategy, which was designed to secure the provinces. So we were fighting the wrong enemy. Not fighting the enemy strategy. So over years, the Taliban used this control of these remote districts, expanded outwards. And then fast forward to April 2021, when President Biden makes his announcement, the Taliban's in control of 73 districts and about 210 are contested. Once he makes the announcement, the Taliban waits 2 weeks for the for that May 1st deadline for that horrific deals that was signed by President Trump. And they pounced. They went on the offensive. Nearly every one of those districts went under Taliban control over the course of about 3.5 months. And then now we're going to fast forward. The Taliban at that point was surrounding the cities and launching attacks in outlying neighborhoods, sometimes inside cities, with its military forces, even as the U.S. is launching airstrikes to try to hold the Taliban back. And now we're at about 2 weeks ago. The Taliban, you have the Eid holiday. That was the end of July. And then the Taliban begins its assault on the cities. Helmand, Lashkargah, Helmand, Kandahar City, Herat, Kunduz City, a host of cities throughout the country. We have to keep in mind the scope of this Taliban offensive. It wasn't just one place and then they moved to the next. They were attacking across multiple theaters. Then August 5th, Zaranj City, the capital of Nimruz in southwestern Afghanistan, is the first to fall. Many thought it would be the last to fall because of where it is and its importance and the fact that there's a Baluch leader and it's a primarily Baluch city. But he made the calculation. He heard that the U.S. military and the Afghan military wouldn't support him, wouldn't provide airstrikes and commandos to defend the city. So he fled. And Zaranj was the first domino to fall. Then city after city over the course of the last 2 weeks, and province after province went under Taliban control. And then we come up to today, where I can calculate that the Taliban controls 32 of the 34 provinces. The only reason, the only reason it's not 33 is because I just can't tell the status of Parwan, which is outside Kabul. It's Taliban controlled. I just can't say it authoritatively. Only Panjshir, the home of Ahmad Shah Massoud, who Al-Qaeda assassinated 2 days prior to 9/11. It is an island in the sea of the Taliban, and it won't be able to hold out much longer. And now I'm going to just step back and take the scope of that Taliban offensive and its brilliance. They took the north. They took away the strategic north, where the Afghan policy, where Afghan officials, Afghan government officials, and the power brokers and the warlords, that was their home. And once they denied that to the Taliban, they, at the same time, they took full control of the east. Then it was time for the south. They swept through the south quickly. Helmand, Kandahar, and all the provinces in the south went under Taliban control. They moved up through the east, and then at that point, it was checkmate. Kabul was surrounded, and Kabul, that as soon as Taliban walked into the city, President Ghani fled. The Taliban took control of the presidential palace, the Ministry of Defense, and every other government building there, while the U.S. is in control of the airport. Barely. We'll talk about that more. And they're on an evac mission, and that's where we are today.
Tom, a very good day to you. Bill's careful explanation, certainly the product of the work that you both have done with your colleagues for years. Well, at what point did you and Bill, in conversing about this between yourselves as you were preparing your page, at what point did you see that the Taliban had a campaign plan and was not just being opportunistic about the local Afghan National Army?
Well, I think Bill and I have documented a number of different campaign plans through the years, but what was new is that obviously the situation was not improving since the U.S. and NATO formally ended their combat operations in 2014. That, of course, was misleading because the U.S. and NATO continued to carry out combat operations since then. But the Afghans were supposed to take the lead from 2014 on, and obviously that didn't happen. It obviously, the U.S. was not successful in transferring the mission. And what Bill and I detected over time was that while the U.S. and Afghan mission was faltering, the Taliban and al-Qaeda and the jihad was gaining steam, was getting more and more potent. By 2018, what we realized is you could put two things together. One was the strategy of the jihadis that Bill was talking, is just so carefully explicated for listeners and explained in detail, and he was right about it all along. You could marry that with the fact that on the American side, the U.S. was operating under the delusion that there was going to be some sort of peace process which was going to lead the jihadis to laying down their arms. That, as we've said many times on your show, John, as you know, was always fanciful, was always delusional. But what it really indicated was that the U.S. had given up on any sense or any desire to try and win the conflict and was actually just looking for a desperate way to get out of it. And so you put those two things together, and then by 2018, we did put them together. We knew it was de facto over, and you can go back and review. This is not something I'm particularly happy about, but you can go back and review our work at the time and see that, in fact, we said the war was over and that the U.S. and Kabul had lost.
Kandahar, was that a significant milestone, Tom, in your measure? That siege of Kandahar we reported 2 weeks ago, did that tell you that the Taliban was going for Kabul, or was that an isolated story because Kandahar is associated with the egress routes from Pakistan and the home of the Taliban?
You know, I think there are several points here that the lesson I took from them was how quickly and swiftly they were able to take over this territory. I think it's very important for people to understand, you know, a lot of people now are looking at this and they're saying, why did the Afghan forces crumble so quickly? And of course they did. There are failures here by the U.S. military in trying to stand up the Afghan forces known as the ANDSF. There are many failures that have been documented and people will continue to document. So I'm not whitewashing those. But what people need to understand is that the Taliban offensive operated at a lightning pace since May 1st because they had already effectively defeated the Afghans on the battlefield. This is what people don't realize, that basically once the U.S. entered this peace deal with this phony peace deal, it was really a withdrawal agreement, this phony peace peace deal with the Taliban in February 2020, the Taliban did a couple things. One, they used this morale boost that they got on their side and the loss of morale on the Afghan side to pick off individual commanders to woo and buy them off. So they started bribing ANDSF commanders off. This really facilitated the ease of their arrival into various locations during this offensive since May 1st. The second thing they were doing was anybody they couldn't buy off or pick off, they went on the assault and they hollowed out Afghan forces. So people are talking about how the Afghans didn't fight for their country since May 1st. But the fact of the matter is a lot of Afghans fought for their country before that, from February of 2020 through May 1st of 2021. Thousands upon thousands of Afghans were killed or wounded during this fighting with the Taliban. As the U.S. is pursuing this fanciful peace process and claiming that there's going to be a negotiated settlement, what that was doing was it was forcing Kabul and Afghan forces to fight for a draw, taking huge casualties as the Taliban and al-Qaeda remained on the offensive fighting for victory.
I'm speaking with Tom Jocelyn and Bill Raggio, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy senior fellows. They keep the Long War Journal, a chronicle, an illustration, an explanation of the years of the battle across the Ummah of the Americans and their allies against the jihadists. We're focusing on Afghanistan now. It is fog of war, but when we come back, what we know about the situation in Kabul, especially the airport, as of the exit of the Afghan government. President Ghani has left the country. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Bill Raggio and Tom Jocelyn of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy's senior fellows. They keep the Long War Journal. And fog of war, and we've talked about the map. We go now to the reporting that is available from Kabul. The media is giving us headlines in London that suggest the center of the concern is now the Kabul airport. Bill, I start with you, because there are stunning, shocking, amazing videos of what appear to be hundreds of young men running beside a C-17, landing, I believe, at Kabul Airport, climbing on the side of the C-17. There are other videos that suggest people have been trying to get on board the C-17. I was under the impression that Kabul Airport was going to be secured for the exit of what the Secretary of State, Mr. Blinken, has said was an orderly evacuation. However, nothing about this appeared orderly. I puzzle where security is because the president has dispatched military units, Army and Marine Corps, and securing the Kabul airport seems straightforward. What do you make of these incomplete fog of war reports of people running beside a C-17, Bill?
Yeah, John, and you said it well. This is anything but orderly. I want to be very clear about this. This is what I am going to say here is not an indictment of the soldiers and airmen and Marines that are on the ground doing an extremely difficult task. They've been given an impossible task. The military leadership failed them, and this airport is not secured. These videos don't lie, John. I saw a video of what appears to be an Afghan falling off of a plane as it's taking off from midair. It's reminiscent of the jumpers from 9/11, from the towers. That means that people are hanging onto the wheel wells of the aircraft to get out of Afghanistan. The tarmac is not secured. There's supposed to be 6,000 Marines in the country, but how is this airport not secured? The answer very likely is it can't be secured, and we probably right now couldn't put enough soldiers and Marines on the ground to secure it. There is a very serious risk right here that I'm going to lay out, and I pray does not happen. If one suicide bomber makes it through that airport, and when you look at those videos, you can see there's just people everywhere. There's no way they're not being controlled. They're not being filtered. If a suicide bomber hangs onto a plane as it takes off and blows up, the U.S. military has a catastrophe of the highest order on its hands. Ground operations will have to cease, and then U.S. soldiers and Marines are going to be forced to clear that tarmac. and they may have to do it via force. And can you imagine, aside from U.S. soldiers and civilians and a wrecked $250 million aircraft, you're going to have videos, and you will have videos this day and age. You're always video. You're going to have videos of that plane smoldering on the tarmac. And you're going to have videos of soldiers opening fire on Afghan civilians. This is a worst case scenario. One of many worst case scenarios that we could think of. And I'm just going to say one more quick thing. When General McKenzie, the commander of CENTCOM, was given the task, because Afghanistan is his AO and he's the commander of Afghanistan, when President Biden announced the withdrawal and they handed over Bagram, he should have insisted it remain open or resigned, because anyone who's been to Kabul or a lieutenant would know, in the U.S. military would know, that you would not want to do an evacuation in Kabul, because the airport is literally in the city. It's a couple of it's like a 5 kilometer drive from the heart of the city, from actual U.S. military, from Resolute Support headquarters, what used to be, that's now Taliban controlled. And you have a mass of people. You needed to get those people to Bagram and then stage the evacuation with the page. McKenzie should have resigned. Instead, he saluted and said, yes, sir. And if one American dies because of this, this is on him, and the American public needs to hold him accountable.
Tom, your measure these last weeks, we've all talked about, was there preparation for evacuation in the case of worst case scenario? The plan B, plan C, plan D. At this point, Tom, in all of your reporting, and you're hearing from lots of voices around the world, what do we understand about why there was not planning to have sufficient aircraft and a secure airfield? Do you see anything on the news or from your colleagues, Tom, that tell us why they weren't prepared?
You know, it's funny, John. I see a lively debate on social media, especially on Twitter, about whether or not this was an intelligence failure, this rapid capture of Kabul. And I'm sure there are intelligence assessments from the CIA and ODNI saying that, you know, Kabul could fall quickly. But the failures that Bill and I are talking about here is that clearly those intelligence assessments did not filter up or were not relied upon by U.S. military commanders who are actually in charge of previously the war fighting and then also the evacuation, because you wouldn't be seeing this scramble to use the airport in Kabul to get out in such a haphazard manner if they had actually really understood how dire the threat was to Kabul. They would have already had the U.S. embassy evacuated weeks ago. They would have used Bagram months ago, as Bill said, to get most of U.S. personnel out. They wouldn't have put themselves in this compromised position in which they're mixed and mingling with civilians in a very, risky situation. If they had actually seen this coming. So when we talk about failures here or intelligence failures, what we're talking about is that basically the military commanders who are in charge of this, you know, whether they understood Kabul was in general under risk or not, they clearly did not plan for this hasty overthrow of Kabul.
The question, Al-Qaeda, when we come back, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, never left the country. In the country, where? What does it mean? What are we witnessing now in Kabul and the other large cities? Tom Jostin, Bill Raggio, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They keep the Long War Journal. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Raggio and Tom Jostin, Senior Fellows, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, observing the fall of the Afghan government, the flight of the Afghan government, and what comes next. Importantly, this is fog of war. We cannot do clarity in an ongoing combat situation, which is true in Kabul, true at the Kabul airport. We can speak to the matter of Al-Qaeda and its attendant deviltry, ISIS. I read from the Financial Times in these last days. This is London reporting. President Biden cited the near collapse of Al-Qaeda, which conducted the September 11th attacks, for his decision to withdraw. But although a UN report in June said Al-Qaeda numbers had dropped to a maximum of 500, It said the group retained extensive ties with the Taliban and was present in 15 Afghan provinces. A quote from a U.S. official in the FT, the Taliban does have success. If the Taliban does have success, they're likely to have Al-Qaeda operating with them. Experts say the jihadi threat would most immediately be felt in the region, in the countries including Pakistan and India, before Al-Qaeda or the local branch of ISIS, sworn enemies of the Taliban who have a foothold in eastern Afghanistan, could set their sights on the U.S. End quote. Tom, you and Bill and your colleagues for years have documented the close links between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. There were political voices in Washington that did not embrace the obvious. That UN report was a moment for the political voices in Washington to come to terms with Al-Qaeda. What is your understanding now of Al-Qaeda and ISIS operating in Afghanistan or in the Pakistan-Afghanistan border region?
John, look, there are three basic failures that Bill and I have been documenting for years. One was the failure of the U.S. military to really understand the Taliban's rural insurgency, which ultimately was the key to their success on the battlefield. The second thing was that this phony peace process, this idea that there is no military solution, that only that the Taliban was interested in negotiating a political settlement with Kabul. We've eviscerated that many times. But the third key thing here is that the U.S. never understood its enemies in Afghanistan going back 20 years. And a key component of that is they not only did they not really understand the Taliban or what motivated or how it operates or what it was all about, they didn't understand Al-Qaeda, and they didn't understand the Taliban's relationship with Al-Qaeda. So when you put this all together, it was a recipe for failure all along. And the bottom line is you see a lot of people now talking about, including the defense minister in the U.K., and General McKenzie at CENTCOM and others talking about Al-Qaeda reconstituting or returning to Afghanistan. This language is all sort of off the mark. The bottom line is Al-Qaeda is there. Al-Qaeda's been there all along. We've documented their presence in so many different ways using so many different types of sources, everything from bin Laden's files, which were captured 10 years ago, to operational data and reporting, to jihadi social media, to all sorts of different ways of showing this and showing that the U.S. didn't really understand what was going on there. And you cite the U.N. report. The U.N.'s reporting is much better on this than a lot of what the Pentagon has put out. But the U.N. would be the U.N.'s authors, the authors of that report, would be very quick to admit that they don't really know how many Al-Qaeda guys are in Afghanistan either. And neither did the U.S. military, the U.S. intelligence community. And when you look at this, what you can see is if you add up certain basic facts, certain basic details, Bill and I could build a case, although there are some assumptions in it, that Al-Qaeda has a much larger presence in Afghanistan than anybody knew all along. You could see our piece on the takeover of Ghazni province, for example, a very strategic province that lies on the road between Kandahar and Kabul. It's backfilled with all sorts of data about how Al-Qaeda's had a persistent presence in Ghazni for more than a decade. You can see it now, and we expect that Al-Qaeda in the coming weeks will basically have a coming out party. They're going to have their sort of their Bane moment from The Dark Knight Rises, where they're going to reveal that they were the shadow army all along.
Bill, you have very carefully followed the Taliban's denial for weeks and months and years that Al-Qaeda is operating in Afghanistan. Those denials went to as recent as a month ago. They were still denying it. The denials were not convincing, but they seem to be strategic now that we understand their plan to march on Kabul. Do you still see denials, Bill? Are they still saying Al-Qaeda's not here? This is a Taliban-only victory.
Yeah, John, that's a great question. I haven't seen them mention it, but I think the Taliban is so focused right now on conquering the country and showing that it's the legitimate government. I suspect that the Taliban probably won't even address this issue going forward unless, like, say, the United Nations comes out with something. But it's probably to their advantage to just ignore that issue from this point on. This denial always, you know, was part of the big lie from the Taliban. In fun fact here, the Taliban was intimately involved with this offensive, and it's most seen. Like, look, we know they're fighting in the east. We know they were help fighting in the south, but in the north, this is where the Taliban Taliban was leveraged its alliance out with Al-Qaeda to the greatest. It took these, the Al-Qaeda helped the Taliban organize these Tajik and Uzbek and other jihadists, Turkestan Islamic Party, Ansarullah, Islamic Jihad Union, Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan. They helped roll them into the Taliban and gave them more northern flavor and allow them to conduct outreach to local communities. And that's how this offensive, part of the reason why the Taliban's offensive was so successful in the north. It's a perfect example of this Taliban Al-Qaeda integration. And the Taliban will deny it, will continue to deny it. But anyone who has even casually observed this, you can see the relationships. You just, if you don't believe it, we see this with the Taliban apologists and experts in the field, so-called experts in the field. It's because they want to deny it, because they have, they want policy decisions to be made that are favorable to them. And if you can't say, let's leave Afghanistan, at the same time recognizing these deep Taliban Al-Qaeda ties.
Tom, Al-Qaeda has been pointing to the Afghanistan success, anticipated success, for some time. We've spoken about Al-Shabaab in Africa. We've spoken about Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, even Al-Qaeda in the Sahel, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. At this point, in your reporting or your information from your colleagues, do you see Al-Qaeda pointing to this for a general offensive in other theaters? Do we see any pattern that's disrupted or anticipated by Al-Qaeda with the march on Kabul?
Well, what I can say with certainty is you can see that the Al-Qaeda victory media tour has already begun. Even as earlier this month, when it became clear that the Taliban was going to win, we saw statements start coming out from Al-Qaeda figures in West Africa and East Africa and Syria and Yemen. And they were starting to cheer on the Taliban offensive. And I think that speaks to another point here that, Bill and I have rebutted so many times through the years. You know, we've talked about how there are a lot of phony experts in the field who play disconnect the dots between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. That's all nonsense. We can easily rebut that. But they also play disconnect the dots between the Taliban Al-Qaeda alliance in Afghanistan and other Al-Qaeda operations elsewhere. And we've been arguing that that's a mistake. There's plenty of connective tissue between these. And in fact, that the Taliban Al-Qaeda victory in Afghanistan will be a boon for the jihadi cause everywhere. And just to think about this right now, Al-Qaeda's leadership in all the areas I just mentioned, in Syria, in Yemen, in Somalia and West Africa, is filled with veterans of the jihad from Afghanistan the first time around. These are guys who were trained in Al-Qaeda's camps in Afghanistan in the 1990s. They now are looking at this and saying, wow, we lost the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan after 9/11, but it's back. We won. We beat the Americans. And these are the guys who are leading the Al-Qaeda charge in these other theaters. It's very difficult to see how they could not be, how this could not be a boon for their cause and for their morale.
ISIS is said to be a smaller and more alienated version of itself from other theaters, Tom. ISIS is said to be at odds with the Taliban and I guess with Al-Qaeda when Al-Qaeda admits that it's present. Do you see ISIS taking advantage of this? I've not seen any reports. It tends to be sectarian battles that ISIS wants to fight. Right now, we're just looking at Kabul, not for attacks on Shia.
You know, look, I mean, this is the point here, John. You just hit on it. You know, ISIS became the shiny new object in counterterrorism circles and for the U.S. military, and they became obsessed with ISIS in Afghanistan, and they were really looking to trumpet any success against ISIS in Afghanistan that they could trumpet. But as Bill and I said, yes, ISIS is capable of mass carnage, of killing a lot of people in Afghanistan in individual attacks, but they're not threatening to take over the country the way the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were. And this was one of the many failures on the U.S. military side. The leadership of the U.S. military became obsessed with ISIS while not understanding that the real threat to their end game, the real threat to the whole project, was coming from the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, which do remain opposed to ISIS overall. In fact, John, you know, it's interesting. We followed the Arabic literature that ISIS has put out through the years. They have this weekly newsletter called Al-Naba that they put out for many years now, and they've had other propaganda pieces they put out. And ISIS has been very critical of the Taliban Al-Qaeda alliance over the years. And I noted on Twitter just yesterday those critiques don't look so strong today if you're a jihadi. You know, this has been a big intra-jihadi rivalry between ISIS on the one side and the Taliban and al-Qaeda on the other. Well, today, if you're a jihadi who's trying to decide between the two, the Taliban and al-Qaeda look ascendant while ISIS looks somewhat morbid.
I'm speaking to Tom Jocelyn and Bill Raggio. They are senior fellows at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. We're dealing with the fog of war in Afghanistan, meaning that there is no certainty for the reporting that's coming through. It's filtered by so many hands, and at the same time, the situation on the ground, you cannot say Kabul is this or Kandahar is that. We can speak to the anecdotes that we're receiving around the edges of what happens next in Afghanistan, what happens next in the region. And when we come back, the reporting right now in London and in Bloomberg is of young women at university in Herat or in Kandahar or in Kabul being told to stay home or to go home or not to report to class. That's all we have now. But what else are we watching for? The Taliban in negotiation in Doha often presented itself as different from the late 20th century. Is it? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Raggio and Tom Jocelyn of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, reporting on what we know to be true in Afghanistan, given the fog of war. The Kabul airport is not secure. We can see this from videos. It can be secured, perhaps, but right now it is not clear what the next steps are to secure the airport, to evacuate those who are eligible or those who are nationals from Great Britain or France, contractors from the U.S. It's not clear. We do know that there are anecdotes coming out of Afghanistan via the internet, although I'm told that the internet, that electricity is down in different parts of the country. So it's not clear who has access to the internet, who doesn't. But in reading a Bloomberg opinion piece this morning, I learned that one young woman, 22 years old, finishing her degree at a university, was told there is no more class for her. The other anecdotes, and we'll get many of these, so I'm not worried about whether they're accurate or not. We're just going to get anecdotes. Told women reporting for their jobs were told to go home and send their husbands in their place. Well, I'm also told anecdotally that there is demand for the heavy burqas, the full body covering that was prominent in the Taliban-centered Afghanistan of the late 20th century. So, Bill, I go to you, and we're looking at the Taliban, and it presented itself at Doha as different from the Taliban of the late 20th century. For example, it said that it would not welcome al-Qaeda again, that that was a tactical mistake. Is there any reporting that you see, Bill, that says that this is a new Taliban, a modern video-prepared Taliban, Bill?
Yeah, John, this is a new Taliban, but it's not as advertised. This is not a moderate Taliban. This is not a Taliban that has sought to honor women's rights and respects freedom of the press and accept an Afghan constitution. Those are all the big lies that have been put out there by the Taliban apologists who own a big part of this failure. But what is new about the Taliban is its ability to use social media, its political savvy, how it used diplomacy to fool the United States, to fool those apologists, to fool the West, to think that it would do the things that everyone said claimed it would do. Its military strategy is it's far more sophisticated. In the 1990s, it was slugging it out. Here we saw a more patient, Taliban. One of the things I've documented over the last decade is the Taliban training camps. You watch these and it's undeniable that that the Taliban has trained military units for very specific actions. We've seen that particularly over the last 4 to 5 years, and it used them to launch its assault. So yeah, there is a new Taliban. It isn't improved from our perspective. It's more dangerous. It's more politically savvy. It knows how to use diplomacy. It knows how to fool the gullible individuals in the West. And it knows it's adept at using social media to promote its cause.
Tom, we've spoken of Al-Qaeda and its controlling hand for many of its presentations in the Gulf, in Africa. The Al-Qaeda influence of the Taliban, is it distinct in some fashion, Tom? Because this is a country that the Taliban has controlled before. Do you see in these 20 years since the U.S. moved in that Al-Qaeda has changed its understanding of how to advise the Taliban?
Well, I'll give you one anecdote I've heard over the last 24 hours from several people in Kabul who have contacted me. They said that they were surprised to hear so many Taliban fighters speaking Russian, that they weren't speaking Arabic or a native dialect, that they were actually speaking Russian. And I said, you know, that's not surprising to us, because part of what Bill and I have been watching for is that Al-Qaeda very successfully integrated these Central Asian jihadist groups into the Taliban hierarchy. Now, some of this occurred before 9/11, but they really ramped up operations over the last 20 years along these lines. And in fact, when the Taliban took over northern Afghanistan, they handed control of key areas there to a commander from Tajikistan, which speaks to the Central Asian dynamic here. And of course, a lot of Central Asian fighters do speak Russian, so it did not surprise me whatsoever that this was an observation that people in Kabul were hearing. I think it speaks to the fact that Al-Qaeda was very successful at integrating these other groups in the Taliban hierarchy and into the Taliban offensive. But this is one of many points of contact between Al-Qaeda and the insurgency. I mean, you know, part of what we've been documenting for so long now is that from Sirajuddin Haqqani, who's the number two of the Taliban, the deputy leader, he's an Al-Qaeda man. From him on down, there are so many points of contact between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And this, again, if there are three big lessons here from recent years of things that America got wrong, to our mind, this is certainly one of them. The U.S. never understood who it's fighting and couldn't really articulate the nature of the enemy. And that, of course, leads to failure.
Bill, your comment, there's plenty of blame. I understand that. And there'll be reports and investigations, and Congress will investigate. The intelligence failure is obvious. Right now, Bill, what are you watching for from the U.S. intelligence officers who have been watching Afghanistan? What will tell you that they've righted the ship and understand what's going on? We have a couple of minutes, Bill.
Yeah, just real quick. And then I want to, again, like as the military personnel on the ground, they're not responsible for this. Neither are the folks that I speak with. There are many clear-headed individuals within the U.S. military and intelligence, but unfortunately, they're not the ones that are, their information is being adjusted to fit political realities. Their assessments are adjusted to fit political realities as they filter up. You know, I don't expect any, administration, military or intelligence, high level officials to accept any blame from this. As a matter of fact, they've been denying it. They've been telling us everything's fine. We were aware that this was a possibility and such things. But what I'm looking at going forward here now, I mean, those are issues that are going to sort themselves out of over time. I hope there's accountability for that, but I doubt there will be. But what I'm looking for right now, it's the tactical. It's what happening at the Kabul airport. It's, do we see Al-Qaeda's hand show itself? Things like that. That's what's most important to me right now.
The reporting that we have now, the fog of war. And in war, I'm always reminded what I learned early on in the Afghanistan conflict. The first three reports are wrong. Wait. We have this from Kabul. Taliban leaders march into Kabul, preparing to take full control of Afghanistan. The militant group took over the presidential palace and said it plans to soon declare a Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. Hours earlier, American-backed President Ashraf Ghani fled the country. That's what we know. That's it. Right now, the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. Bill Raggio, Tom Jocelyn, They and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. I highly recommend watching the Long War Journal for their reporting and also for their podcast, Generation Jihad. This is CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.